All right, we're back, and it's evening for a change.
Yeah, we don't do evening too often.
We don't.
The following morning is usually pretty brutal.
It depends on how late we're up and
what
we're up to here.
What we're drinking.
And what we're drinking. Well, and that leads to my question, which is, what would make you more upset if I told you I was drinking a hazy, juicy, sessionable double IPA thingy, or if I told you I was drinking a Fuller ZSB that I know you can't get near you? Which one makes you more
the
angry?
Hazy, lactosey, whatever thing.
Oh, because I'm drinking a Fuller's. I thought that would make you more sad.
No, that makes me proud to know that you have integrity.
No, I don't really like it. I'm only drinking
it. Oh, I figure you're just going to open it and dump it down a drain.
No, it is quite tasty. And it's a rarity to get a drink in a bottle anymore.
That's true. Mine comes in a bottle, but it's a Tennessee Sour Mash Whiskey. So I haven't found that
my.
In cans
okay.
yet.
And you just refilled
yes.
that, didn't you?
Yeah,
before
I did.
We start. Oh, crap. Okay, we better get started here so that this can end before you end. You do not need that. You know, I read something today, and we're only a few months away from Dry January.
What?
Again.
What is?
Yeah, it's October.
What? I don't
dry
know what
January.
About.
Well, do you know
I
what
do,
it is
yes,
now?
I know
apparently,
what it is.
It's sober October.
Not in this household, it isn't.
Not in this one either. But,
nope.
No, thank you.
So you have a sober October, and then a no shave November or whatever, and then
Movember.
Yeah, no, that's just wrong too. And then the whole month of December just needs to go away. And then you've got another dry January. What is wrong with people?
I don't know. If you need to crowdsource your healthy activities, you got bigger problems.
That's true. And I definitely don't come asking me because, damn, not having it.
I sat in the parking lot and ate fried cheese sticks today. So I'm not a healthy example for anyone.
I was going to say, wow, that could pretty much be anywhere in Wisconsin.
Well, that's true. That is quite
church
true.
Church parking lot, you know, whatever.
So I'm going to mess with a buddy of mine tomorrow. We're going to sit around and watch a little football, and he's a stout and porter kind of guy. And I'm going to slip him a non-alcoholic stout and not tell him it's non-alcoholic. And I just want to get an honest reaction to, hey, what do you think of this one? It's one of my new favorites. And just see what it is and what he says when I tell
That'll
him there's no booze in it.
Mm-hmm. Technically, there's less than 0.3% alcohol in it. So it's not like zero, but it's low enough to call it no alcohol, NA.
So I'm curious if he gets angry at me for the bait and switch, but we'll see how it goes. I'll report back next time on what happens there. So what else is going on? We have a new patron, Jim, from Blue Cedar Hops in Florida.
Hey, Jim.
Very exciting. Welcome, Jim. Thank you for joining us. And that's it. We're here. We're drinking. Evening recording. All good. Is that it? We're done? 6 o'clock, 6 minutes,
yep.
And we're done.
Thanks, everybody.
Good night.
Good night. Yeah, so what do we want to talk about today? We're going to talk about irrigation systems. We're going to talk about irrigation systems. Yeah. Because you couldn't think of anything else to talk about.
We need to talk about stuff going on in the field, and that is your area.
Oh, okay. All right. Yeah. So I figured irrigation systems, it's always timely to talk about mechanical things. There's no season, north or south hemisphere, that can ever escape the clutches of a good irrigation system.
Oh, and we've spoken about, we had a water episode a ways back. And that was really about not so much systems, but about volumes of water and timing.
Yeah,
and all that.
Yeah,
and,
that was the,
you know, that was different. That was science,
like the physiological or horticultural demand of water in the plant and all that good kind of stuff. But how that water gets there is a whole nother topic. There's so many different ways
buckets.
One can go. Buckets, that is an option.
Buckets. We just had a conversation at dinner tonight about how you fill swimming pools on the top of large buildings in big cities. Mm. And my daughter, who's usually more clever than this, suggested an enormous funnel when it rains. You just collect all the water.
That is an option. Mm-hmm. Should we do the math to figure out how much rain it would take and how big of a funnel you would need? No, that's not fun for anybody but me.
No. There's some pi r squared in there somewhere.
No, so this whole idea of how you get that water to the plant is timely. I know there are some folks in the U.S., certainly in our hopnologist group, that are trying to size an irrigation system. You know, just even some questions is apparently on the surface as simple as how big of a pump do I need is not that simple. And, you know, our favorite answer, well, it depends. Well, what does it depend on? I'm only irrigating an acre. Okay, well, you're irrigating that acre all at once. What diameter is the tube? How many elbows do you have? Do you have any restrictions the water has to pass through? All these sorts of things lead up to designing how big your pump needs to be, mm-hmm. and how big your water source needs to be. You know, what is the bottleneck? What's the factor that is going to restrict, or I should say is going to dictate what your system needs to look like. So I figured we could just talk about those critical aspects of an irrigation system so people, maybe we can demystify it for them a little bit. Yes, there's a ton of math involved. We're not going to go through it here, but it's all fairly simple stuff you can find online when you're trying to figure this stuff out.
And I have to think, I mean, you talked about the bottlenecks. Available water, I imagine, correct me if I'm wrong, the first thing you've got to do is determine what's available. I know one of the things when we had our charter grower program, if anyone said they were using their household well to water their farm, that was a huge red flag for us.
It certainly was. If they were going to do anything more than, well, our minimum was an acre. And even then, that's a lot of expectation from your well pump and your pressure tank. Assuming you were on a well, some people were even on city water and they're like, oh, I'm just going to, you know, I'll use the, you know, going to use a 3/4-inch garden hose off the back of their house for, you know, for your 1/4-acre hop garden. That's great. For an acre, not only are you going to pay through the nose for that water coming from the city, but it's probably also going to be chlorinated and all kinds of things, which you don't want to do. So we're going to be talking about ground-sourced water or surface water. Let's just call it surface water, whether that's going to be a well or a body of water, a lake, a pond, a stream. What does that look like? So we're going to assume that in one of those cases, the water is typically always there, like a well. So you drive down, you know, you drill a well. Some people have what they call sand points, which is just basically a pipe with a screen on it and a really sharp, solid steel point that you literally pound into the ground when your water table is really, really high. But you're like, hey, I got water. Look at that. That's great. But the amount of water that you're going to need is going to be determined by, you know, like how much area, you know, acreage, hectare, you know, how much are you going to water at any given time? Because we could say, okay, well, I'm just going to do this acre and I don't want to goof around with valves and timers. I just want to water the whole thing at once. Okay, let's do that. So I told you there wasn't going to be any math, but there's going to be math. What we can do is we can say, okay, James, how much water do I need to be able to supply? Okay, well, how are you going to supply that? To your point, buckets? Are you going to go out there, you know, gunga din and carrying water all over the place? No, mm-hmm. You're going to most likely in the modern age use drip line. And there's two kinds of drip line. There's one we call pressure compensated and non-pressure compensated. Well, what does that mean? Besides the fact that one compensates for pressure. Well, you've seen like at the home store, home big box stores, garden center, you've got soaker hoses. You're like, well, I'll just throw some soaker hose out there. That's what you do, right? Basically, it's a bunch of recycled ground up tires that are kind of fused together. And it's a really porous hose. So you turn the pressure on. And water just kind of weeps out of this thing all the way along its length. But if you look at that really closely, what you're going to find is that you're going to have more water weeping out closer to the spigot than at the far end of the hose. That's because you're losing pressure along the way. So water is going to, much like air in drying, is going to follow the path of least resistance, and it's going to pump out or, you know, effuse out of that hose the closest to the point where there's the highest pressure. So that would be at the beginning of the line. Because as that water is being pushed through that tube, pipe, conduit, whatever, it's encountering friction along the way. The interaction of the water along the inside of that vessel. That's slowing it down. That's robbing it of energy. Which is, you know, kind of, then it's going to take more energy to get behind it to push it all the way to the end. Except you can't put energy behind it in one of those situations with like a soaker hose, because you're just going to, again, it's going to take the last, like the path of least resistance. It's going to pump out of the hose and you're going to end up, you're going to have a lot of water coming out right at the beginning, and about halfway down the tube, it's not going to be hardly anything.
Yep.
Now, that's great on flat ground. What if you have it on an incline? It either gets better or worse. If you're pumping downhill, you know, it wants to run downhill. So you could end up having more water come out down at the end of the tube than at the top. That's where the pressure compensating part comes in. So it's these little widgets that are inside of the tube at every little hole emitter location that compensates for no matter what the pressure happens to be in the tube, whether it's 35 PSI at the very beginning of the tube or 7 PSI at the very end of that run, they're always going to emit, they're always going to drip a certain amount. So it takes all of that potential variability out of the equation.
And correct me if I'm wrong, but depending on where you've got that length, you can have different emitters in different places.
Potentially, you could if they were what we call external. The situation I just described were internal pressure compensating. So these little widgets are installed during the manufacture of the tubing. So when you have a large acreage, just ask Thad from our owner's group. Our first acre, he hand punched in, what was it, 1,000 individual emitters? Yeah.
And did he lose a bet?
How does that happen? Well, what he did was he's like, oh, we're not going to pay, you know, an extra 18 cents for integral emitters. We're going to use external ones. I'll punch them in. He still complains that his golf game is ruined because of the tendonitis he has in his elbow from punching in all those external emitters. So we'll get to that in a second. But no, you're right. If you had a solid tube, you could go along and you could punch in different types of emitters in different places if you wanted to. Mm-hmm. But I'm not recommending that our listeners do that. I'm recommending our listeners go with an integral pressure compensated emitter style. And you can get them in all different emitter spacings. People say, well, my plants are a meter apart. Can I get them, you know, should I have one emitter per plant? You could. You can get them with emitter spacings of 1 meter. But you can also get them with, you know, emitter spacings of half a meter, or let's just say 18 inches, so that you're basically irrigating on the crown or right next to the, or on either side of the crown. Think about it like that, which is what I kind of advocate. Or even for, you know, you could go even closer, you know, every 12 inches. Spacing is important to know. So the question originally was, how much water do I need? Well, again, how much water are we putting out per hour is usually what they're rated at. Your goal is to get as uniform of a water application as possible. So that would say the more emitters, the better. You know, there is some practicality there, because usually when you get closer and closer emitter spacings, the price goes up a little bit more because you have more of those little widgets on the inside of a tube. But let's just say for giggles that we're going to go every 18 inches or every half meter or so. So for every plant, you've basically got 1.5 to 2 emitters. So you can think about it like that. So let's just use easy math. I got 1,000 plants on the acre, and I'm going to have 1.5 emitters per plant. That's 1,500 emitters pumping out water at some volume per hour. Typically, you see them in one half, 1 gallon, 1.5, and 2 gallons an hour. So again, keeping things simple, most common what I see is 1 gallon per hour. So 1 gallon times 1,500 emitters is 1,500 gallons per hour. What does your house well pump deliver in gallons per hour? People are like, I don't know. Usually it's somewhere around 12 to 15 gallons per minute, like full bore wide opened. You know, you can say, let's just say 15 times 60 is 900 gallons per hour. No, you're not going to irrigate an entire acre because your well pump won't deliver that kind of volume. You need, let's just say, twice that much water. So now what are you going to do? Are you going to dig a bigger well? Well, yes, I suppose you could. Or you could just not irrigate the whole thing at once. So now you have to have a valve in the system somewhere to shut off part of it. So you're like, okay, well, I need to irrigate half, so I'll just put a valve on one half and only do one half at a time. I'll live with that. Great, you can do that. But now you can't do laundry or wash your dishes or anything for an hour because you're going to be using every ounce of oomph that your well pump has got and volume that it can deliver. Oh, yeah, so don't even flush the toilet. You got problems there. So you can see, and that's just for an acre. And so people that want to creep up on an acre and they're using their house, you know, well, their house water supply to creep up on this, quickly, very quickly discover that they can't apply that much water.
And that when it creeps up on you like that, that's, you think you're okay. And then all of a sudden you're not.
Yeah. You're okay until you're not. And with water and hops, it's night and day. And it's not a quick fix. It's an expensive fix usually. So doing this right out of the gate and getting that design right is important. So that's using groundwater. Granted, now if you're using a surface water supply, you're like, I got this huge pond over here, or I've got a stream that I'm allowed to pull out of. Wisconsin listeners, you can't do that without a permit from the Department of Natural Resources, just saying. But some people are like, oh, I got a stream on my property. I'm going to pump water out of that. Should you really be doing that?
what's going into that stream?
Well, not only that, but ecologically speaking, not a good idea. Plus, what happens when you get into a drought scenario and that stream gets to a trickle and you can't pump enough water out of it to begin with? Right at the worst time. So your water security is really not as great as you think it might be using a surface water source. So any serious grower out there is going to be looking at groundwater, and they're going to be driving wells. And you want to talk about spendy. Like, for instance, in Wisconsin, if you're pumping over 80 gallons a minute, it's considered a high-capacity well. So when you're dealing with a large area that all needs irrigated, unless you're going to be running a single pump round the clock, you're going to be dealing with some very high capacities. Our well pump for our large farm was 300 gallons a minute. 300 gallons a minute. Those big mini tote containers that you see, maybe for those of you in ag country that are on the backs of ag trucks, the big cubes, those are 275 gallons. So I could fill one of those in a minute.
Jeez. And you know, you think, you said something before that I just want to reiterate, which is that you got to plan this out carefully if you're expanding. This is not one of those things where you can do it and then decide a few years later, okay, now we need to go bigger. It's not like a tractor where you can buy one and then sell it, make most of the money back, and then buy a larger one. You don't really get a second chance when you're doing this kind of a thing.
Would you call it a sunk cost?
Oh.
Thanks, folks. I'm here all night. Try the veal.
Wow. I apologize on behalf of my business partner here. That's,
yeah.
Ooh, wow.
That's part when we try to educate people on non-linearity of hop production and certainly of expansion. That is a huge factor. People don't get it until all of a sudden they're like, yeah, my first well I put in cost me, you know, $3,500. My second well I put in cost me $19,000, which is me. That was me, right?
Mm-hmm. But and you got nothing back from the first one.
No, zero
at all.
Other than water. I mean, it was still mm-hmm. there, and it could provide a little bit, but not compared to its big brother. You know, the first well we put in had a 3.5 or 4 inch casing, and we're like, oh, we're in the big time now. Yeah. The next well we put in had an 8.5 inch wide casing. That's full of water and moving at 300 gallons a minute. So it's an ugly, ugly day when you come to that realization. You're like, oh, crap, got to do that. So back to where we're getting at. So we've got the volume of water. So you've done your math. You're like, okay, I need this much volume. Is that volume purely there? Yes or no? Yep, I have the volume. I can deliver the volume. How are you going to deliver the volume? Well, I'm going to use a pump. Yep, that's the next step. How big does the pump need to be? Well, it's got to be able to pump. Let's say I'm going to do an acre at a time. It's got to be able to pump 1,500 gallons an hour. Okay, I can do that. But at what pressure drop? Oh, now we're back to the fan thing and drying. It's all that friction that the water is going to see, or that the water is going to go through, and that the pump has to overcome, that we need to get to. And every pump has something called a pump curve. Even if you're going to the big box store and you're buying an irrigation booster pump, it's going to show a pump curve. It's going to say it'll deliver this volume of water, liters per hour or gallons per minute, whatever, at this much head. H-E-A-D. What the hell is head? Is another unit of measure? Yeah, so it's basically a unit of measure that is equivalent to the amount of energy it would take to pump that water straight up against gravity. So head pressure. Every bend that water has to go through in a pipe, the size of the pipe, what the material is, the pipe's made of, valves, all that kind of stuff, add pressure drop, add friction, add interference that the pump has to overcome. So when people say, okay, well, I can get a pump that delivers that much volume change, then it only costs me $300, but you're saying I need a $1,500 one. Yep, because have you calculated your head loss due to all of your friction? No. Yeah, do that once and see how that adds up. And one of my favorite go-tos online is called Engineering Toolbox. If you just put that in your Google machine, it'll come up. It's got freaking every conversion table, factor, anything you could ever want to know is in Engineering Toolbox. And it's one of my bookmarked pages in my browser.
I'm pretty sure we already point toward them on the resources page on our website. If we don't, we will. But I'm 99% sure we've referred to them in the past.
I use it all the time. And I think it was it like 2 weekends ago? I was in my workshop goofing around with stuff and getting pinged on the Discord about this topic. And I was just wandering over to the computer in my workshop while my machine was working and looking on the Engineering Toolbox and doing head loss calculations for one of the hopnologists. Figuring out, yeah, I understand you can find that pump for $300 that says it will put out this many gallons per minute. Just like a window box fan will put out 2,000 CFM of airflow. But as soon as you put a piece of tissue paper in front of it, it drops to zero. It's the same with the pump. That pump could do 1,500 gallons an hour, but as soon as you put any kind of restriction on it, it drops down to 15. Because it just doesn't have the power behind it to move the water. So that's the next aspect in this calculation, is adding up all those little widgets and doodads, gigaws in your system that add friction to the water that you're going to have to overcome with the power of your pump. And the more powerful the pump, the bigger the price tag. End of story. So people, again, they say, how big of a pump do I need, James? You need to show me what your irrigation system looks like. Literally, every 90-degree, 45-degree elbow you have, every change in orifice diameter, all that stuff. What is everything made out of in order to add it up to know what you need? Otherwise, you're guessing. And this isn't something you need to guess about.
Because you do not want to have to do it all over again.
No, and I didn't go to school for this. This is all stuff I learned online. Those resources are out there. It's there just for you to pick up and take. We've gone through all of that to figure out, okay, this is how much this entire area is going to need of water. This is how big my pump needs to be, and this is how much water I'm going to need to be to deliver. Oh, crap, that's more than I can do. What am I going to do now? Well, you can subdivide it, and that's where our valves come in. So you don't have to do the whole thing at once. You can do parts. Irrigate the first third and then the second, and then the third. Yeah, granted, your pump's running that whole time, but you're delivering, you know, if you divide it into thirds, you're delivering, you know, 33% of the total only in one go. So your pump can be smaller. Your recharge rate on your water source can be lower. It makes sense all around instead of trying to just irrigate everything all at once. If you were water rich, like some of our cranberry hop growers are, they've got water all over the place and they have large scale water moving infrastructure, then yeah, you turn on 40 acres at once. You're just like, meh, turn it on, may or go, right? But it's also being driven by a 16-cylinder cat diesel engine.
this probably does not represent the majority of our listeners.
Probably not. It's that is our ultra niche podcast. It's mm-hmm. got like six listeners. The valving allows us to reduce the overall burden on our water resource and get into something that's more comfortable in terms of price point and maintenance and approachability in a pump compared to, oh, say something your city might have or a golf course in a deep well scenario. So that's what valves do. Also, valves allow us to control how much water any certain area is getting, because some you may have on a much larger acreage, you might have some regions, you know, your soil type is going to change. So some zones may need more water than others. You know, maybe it's way sandier over there in that corner. So that one's going to need to be on a different schedule than the one that's on the other side of the farm that's maybe further down the slope and is a lot heavier or siltier soil.
And that's an important point in terms of planning, because you don't look at your 6 acres and say, I'm going to have 6 zones, an acre zone, I'm set. You need to really look at everything and make sure when you're building all your different zones that you're building them for the right reasons.
Correct. Add in the aspect of varieties to that as well. To know, you need to know your soil type to understand what varieties should probably be going where, given their nature for putting up with wet feet, basically. You know, do they need drier ground? Do they, you know, were they born and raised in the Pacific Northwest of the United States, or are these more, you know, traditional Hallertauer German type hops that don't mind wet feet and heavy soil? That plays into it too.
Man, it's a lot of work.
Yeah. Oh man, we're half an hour into this podcast and I'm just getting started. Okay. So then you're like, okay, well, that's great. I can put valves in and I can manage that. That's not a big deal. So I'll just go out there and open up this zone and water it a little while, then close it and then open up the other one a lot, water it a little while. Yep, you can put in manual valves if you want, but that's going to get real old real fast, because you're going to be off doing other stuff, or you're going to be away at the boat show or something, and you're going to want to know, or you're going to want to irrigate your hops. So that's where the irrigation controller comes in. So you're going to set it up on a timer, and it's going to open every zone for X amount of time on these certain days and be open for a certain amount of time and then close, and you're done. It's going to start and stop the pump for you. A good irrigation controller for a small-scale hop grower is going to be $100 or less. Buy it. Do it now. Well, not right now. I mean, in half an hour when we're done talking. Then do it. It's absolutely worth its weight in gold. And nowadays, they've got apps. If you've got Wi-Fi near your controller, you can have an app on your phone and monitor your irrigation system. Mm-hmm. It's awesome. And get a sensor that sits on the outside of the building that measures rainfall, so you're not irrigating when you don't need to. So that sensor will override the controller if it knows that there's precipitation. Yep. Pretty easy.
Why? Yeah, it should be. Technology is a wonderful thing.
It is. We love it. If you go a step beyond that, and there's irrigation controllers that plug into weather stations that can add a data stream into your overall download that shows you, okay, this is what my evapotranspiration coefficient is. So if you dig way back into the deep content of our podcast, you can find out where we talk about evapotranspiration coefficients. And you can say, based on what the weather is saying my plants should be using for water, I can have that control my irrigation system. So pinpoint irrigation. And that's really where the future is. It's fun. I love it. And it's a thing. It's stuff. It's that infrastructure stuff people can dig their fingers into and get excited about because, you know, hey, tools, and we get to buy cool stuff. But don't take it for granted that it's just, oh, it's just a bunch of tubing and we just roll it out there and turn it on and everything's good, right? Yeah, no, it doesn't work that way.
And it's one of those, I'll say, nice things that, you know, the question of, well, when do I harvest? There's art and science to that. There's experience to that. Setting up the water, this is pure science and math, and there are wrong ways to do this. There are absolutely wrong ways to do this.
Oh, yes. We've both seen them. It's it's ugly.
Yep.
And there's ingenious ways to do them. You know, there's a friend of ours, hop grower, Orville, Orv in Iowa, that we helped, God, going on 12 or 14 years ago. This is back in the heady days of small-scale hop production. And we had to lift water straight up 120 feet over a rocky nub and onto the plateau where his hop yard was. So we had a lift station because he had a pond down there with a couple of check valves. And then we had a reservoir up top, which were a bunch of those mini totes, call them our water battery, that filled those. So there's a big high-powered, high-flow pump down at the bottom. It was a gasoline-powered pump that was on a float switch, so it would turn on and off by itself, that would just fill these tanks. It had very little ability to deal with friction. It was all power. So it was a 3-inch line, not quite straight up, but pretty damn close. And then that filled up a reservoir, and then out of that we had a different pump that was designed to push through high friction situations but at a lower volume. So there's ways to do this, even when you think that there is no way to do this.
Hmm. And that's a great example of dividing the problem into multiple simpler answers than trying to figure it all out. You know, because if you're trying to pump up and then out all at once, you know, too much going on there.
It is. And you ultimately, could we have found him a pump that would do everything at once? Probably. Mm-hmm. But it would needed a mortgage for it. Because pumps and fans, they're all the same thing. When you're moving a fluid, they do one or two things really great. One of the things is moving a high volume. You can get pumps and fans that move a high volume super easy, but as soon as you put a restriction in there, they turn for shit. Likewise, you can have pumps and fans that work great against extremely high restrictions and forces. But ask them to put out high volume in the face of no restrictions, and they're for shit.
Well, look at your drill. It's speed versus torque.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a good one. Totally, speed versus torque. That's exactly right. Same thing comes with pumps. So keep that in mind. What is your particular scenario? You're like, damn it, James, it's another thing that's just not... Where's my easy button and hop growing? You're thinking of corn and soybeans. Oh, no, that's... Sorry, that was not... Yeah, no, those aren't easy either. But they do have a bajillion more dollars of research behind them, which helps with the ease.
I thought we were the easy button.
Yeah.
Hopology.com.
There's nobody who's listened to more than one of our podcasts and thought, these guys know what's going on. They've got all the easy answers. Holy mackerel. So we've got all the volume of water you want. We know how we're moving it. And we're able to divide up the water flow based on what we want it to do. And we've got a computer to do it for us. What could go wrong? We're done, right? Set it and forget it. So, okay, I'll give you an easy button and hops. If you've done your homework up front and you've gone through this exercise, easy button. Because the components that are in the system, as long as you're not super cheaping out and buying sketchy used solenoid valves from some guy in a dark alley, it's pretty low maintenance, and you can pretty much count on the fact that it's going to work year over year, except for those of us who live in cold climates. Because we fill up the system full of water, and then it freezes, and water expands when it freezes, and that's bad news for anything that's trying to keep it from expanding. So you can get a lot of damage that occurs in the wintertime if you've got freezing temperatures in an irrigation system. So you want to make sure that you purge that irrigation system. And we usually use compressed air for that. But nevertheless, like even though we had a giant industrial air compressor that we could purge 2-3 dozen acres of irrigation tubing at a time with, every spring, we just got to the habit of turning the irrigation system on and sending people out and looking for the geysers. Because whatever it was, loved to chew on our irrigation tubing, and we're not talking mice and little like scratchy nibbly parts. We're talking like sharp, pointy teeth, like opossums or raccoons or something, badgers. Every year, it was just this: turn it on and spend 2 days over 30-40 acres with a couple of teams running around looking for the leaks. We could have taken all that irrigation tube in the fall, which is what they do in the Pacific Northwest. It's an option. It's just something that we're just like, well, that's one other thing to do, I guess. We'll deal with the chewing.
Yeah. Where do you think you'll spend less time? Because we just spent several episodes talking about planning and cleanup and prepping so that you don't waste a lot of time when the next season rolls around. This is one of those decision points. What's worth your time?
I was willing to deal with the sacrifice to Mother Nature of some irrigation tubing to allow us to deal with bigger issues that could cripple us, like the breakdown of a harvester or or a tractor malfunctioning. I can fix a spurting irrigation hose pretty quickly with a pipe clamp and not really worry about losing too much there. But it is an issue, and it's not the irrigation system, even well designed, is not maintenance free, but it should be maintenance low enough maintenance that it's not one of those things that's on your like daily checklist to think about.
And I imagine our whole nightmare scenario of, you know, shit breaks on a Friday afternoon and who do you call probably really only pertains to the pump. I mean, the rest of your system, to your point, is okay, we've got a leak, we can fix that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I would agree with that. And there's been a couple of times where, you know, it was what is going on with this pump? And, you know, granted, when you're dealing with an 8.5-inch diameter well, that's a big ass pump sitting down in that well. And that's not something I'm going to haul up myself. So over the close to 15 years we were doing Gorse Valley, I'm on a first name basis with the well guy, to the point where we were working in our basement about three or four weeks ago, and suddenly the pump stopped working, well pump stopped working. And I haven't talked to Brad in a couple of years at this point. He owns Webster's Drilling here just north of Madison. And I looked at my phone. I still had his personal cell phone number. He goes, and without skipping, I call him without skipping a beat. Brad says, "What's broke?" I'm like, "Hey, Brad, it's James. I thought you sold the farm." I did. This is my house. He's like, "Uh-oh. Do I need to come out?" This is Sunday night at 6 o'clock.
Oh, gee.
Right? But he would have come over if I asked him to. And, yeah, that's another one of those things in the hop industry. You just meet good people.
And people are used to, you know, when you're in any type of service like that, I would imagine from Friday at noon through Sunday evening is when most people realize, oh crap, I've got some kind of problem. No one calls you on a Wednesday at 9 a.m. It just doesn't happen.
Rarely. Yeah. So don't be surprised. I mean, these type of things, as your system expands, as you expand as a grower, whether that's you're expanding in just pure production or you're expanding your business and your sort of your activity level in whatever yield scale you're at right now, these are the things you're going to become more and more intimate with. And they shouldn't be things that are mysteries to you. And know your limits. Know when you need to call on a professional. Because, frankly, the amount of time you're going to try and suss it out yourself and still not be confident that you have the answer on something that's a critical part of your hop production infrastructure, don't mess with it. Call somebody who knows what the hell they're doing. It took me a long time to realize that short litany of mistakes that I made in my hop business. That was one of them, is not relying on professionals and paying them what they're worth.
I apologize on behalf of my business partner here.